From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, former Dean William Strample, Larry Nassar's boss at Michigan State, arrested and charged.
Strample is set to be charged with four crimes, three of which are misdemeanors. One is a high court misdemeanor, and then one is a felony.
But if you're MSU, this is not a headache that you need right now.
The crisis we all face, elder care.
We're all getting older. Our parents are getting older. You're going to find yourself either trying to figure out how to care for an elderly relative or finding care for yourself. It's going to happen.
And we talk with the author of the dystopian new novel, Title 13.
All of us inside the country, no matter how connected we are through social media and all kinds of things like never before, we're lonelier than ever before.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello there, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up later this hour, an economist's family situation has her thinking about elder care.
For now, we're fortunate that I have a sister who can take care of our mother, but we can't count on that indefinitely, nor can our society count on family members, especially wives and daughters, to take care of the growing number of elderly.
So, how can we do better for our seniors? But first, the fallout from the worst sexual assault scandal in sports history is not over. William Strample is the former dean of Michigan State University's College of Osteopathic Medicine, and he was Larry Nassar's boss. Strample was arrested last night and arraigned today on felony and misdemeanor charges. Michigan Radio's Shana Roth was at a news conference that was held today by Special Prosecutor Bill Forsyth. He's the one leading Attorney General Schuette's probe into MSU's role in the Nassar case. Shana, what did we learn from today?
Well, we learned a lot today, not necessarily from the press conference, but from the complaint that we were able to get from the courthouse. It looks like Strample is set to be charged with four crimes, three of which are misdemeanors. One is a high court misdemeanor, and then one is a felony.
All right, so break down the charges for us.
Okay, so let's start with the big one, the felony. This is a five-year felony, and it's misconduct of a public official. And the basis for this is actually quite a bit of behavior between Strample and multiple female students at MSU. This includes essentially saying suggestive things to them. According to one of the victims, Strample went on a rant degrading her appearance, telling her she needed to dress like a woman, clarifying that she was never going to make it in the profession if she did not dress sexier. So that's part of it. Another part of this charge involves things that were found on his work computer. According to the police report, they uncovered approximately 50 photos of various nude and semi-nude women and other types of pornography. And this includes selfies of female MSU students. If we get into high court misdemeanor, and that is criminal sexual conduct fourth degree. So Strample is accused of groping the buttocks of one of these victims without her consent. And then there are two counts of willful neglect of duty, and these are one-year misdemeanors. And this is where Larry Nassar really starts to come into the picture. Strample is accused of essentially not following policies that were put into place after a Title IX investigation of Nassar. So Strample did not make sure that Nassar used gloves during examinations, that he got patient consent for certain types of examinations, that there were other people in the room. And then another count of those two willful neglect of duties is really focused on he allowed Nassar, allegedly, to see patients in between the start of the Title IX investigation and before it was finished.
Give us an idea, Shana, of the kinds of punishments these charges carry.
These are all pretty serious charges. I mean, the felony carries 5 years and or $10,000 fine. The high court misdemeanor, that's the criminal sexual conduct fourth degree, he's looking at possibly up to 2 years in jail and or $500. And then the two regular misdemeanors, those are 1 year and or $1,000. So he is looking at prison time, potentially.
Did the special prosecutor answer any questions or shed more light on where the investigation is going?
No, Prosecutor Forsyth made it very clear that this is an ongoing investigation, and he was really kind of there just to give explanation of the charges and to give a little bit of a background of how they got to this point. But no, he was very reluctant to answer any questions, even though reporters did try.
Well, because news of Strample's arrest broke last night, this morning the criminal complaints were made available to the public. Why was there a press conference today?
I think a part of it was just to make sure that everybody was on the same page. You know, not everybody trekked out to the courtroom this morning at 8 a.m. and waited around for the complaint, but they did have copies of the complaint and the police report to give out to reporters at the press conference. So I think this was really to give everybody the background that they might need and to explain what these charges are, because a lot of these instances or accusations kind of bleed into each other a little bit. So it's kind of to sort of show this is where this one starts, this is where this one starts, and this is what we're saying with this charge or that charge.
Michigan Radio's Shayna Roth checking in from Lansing. Thanks so much, Shayna.
Thank you.
We've got Michigan Radio's Kate Wells with us now. She has covered the Larry Nassar story from the very beginning. So Kate, William Strample was Larry Nassar's boss. So he oversaw the MSU clinic where Larry Nassar molested young athletes. And MSU's stance has been all along that Larry Nassar was an outlier, the only one who committed a crime. So what do these charges today tell us?
Well, I mean, these are very damning charges if they are, in fact, true to exactly what you said, MSU's argument that all along with this Larry Nassar case, this has been just one very bad guy acting completely independently with, you know, no institutional cover. And what these charges are alleging is directly that, saying, like, look, here is a guy whose actions or lack of taking responsibility, lack of doing his basic job, directly allowed Nassar to continue assaulting many women after he was reinstated. They're basically saying if Strample had done his job and actually taken some time to follow up on whether or not Nassar had a chaperone present, whether he was getting actual consent from patients, whether he was even wearing gloves, that there's a lot of people who wouldn't have been sexually abused. One of those young women is Emma Ann Miller. We heard from her at Larry Nassar's criminal sentencing.
I, too, was sexually assaulted by Larry Nassar multiple times at multiple appointments. My last treatment was in August 2016. A week later, he was let go by MSU. I'm possibly the last child he will ever assault.
There's no way to hear that and not just be moved to your core.
Yeah, that kid's 15.
And I remember you reporting on Dr. Strample's reaction when Rachel Denhollander's story broke in the Indianapolis Star. Her story of abuse, Strample wrote in an email something about her video being the cherry on the cake of his day.
There's been a lot of frustration around Strample for a while, both from Denhollander feeling like these emails that came out, she feels like they show that Strample wasn't taking these allegations seriously, that he should have been doing more to actually believe these women rather than Nassar. And there's just a lot of frustration around how MSU handled Nassar during that time overall, not just with Strample, that the Title IX investigation cleared him, exonerated him, let him go back to work while there was still an ongoing criminal investigation.
But meantime, a lot of today's charges against the former dean have to do with his own behavior and conduct as dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine. You've been going through the police complaints.
They are, they're quite a read. They're, as you mentioned, most of this is completely separate from Nassar. So having nothing to do with the allegations against Nassar or whether or not Strample essentially turned a blind eye. These are at least four women, they're unnamed victims, one through four, coming forward and saying, look, while we were med students and Strample was essentially in charge with their future, they were worried about getting kicked out of med school or they'd gotten a bad grade or something had happened, and Strample would summon them into his office and essentially explicitly sexually harass one of them. To give you an example here, according to victim one, she was 26 years old at the time. Strample suggested that 26-year-old women can put out for 20 minutes with an old man, after which he would fall asleep, and in return, the women could get the benefit of a free vacation. It's these kinds of instances that these women are alleging obviously made them feel deeply uncomfortable, and in one case, he allegedly went so far as to actually grab one of them and grope her.
So female students in fear of being thrown out of med school, and he is the guy that can make it or break it for them.
Apparently, that's what is being alleged here. He's not very subtle about it. At one point during a group meeting, he said, literally, I hold your future in my hands and I can do whatever I want with it.
So what do you feel this could mean for Michigan State University, Kate, in terms of more lawsuits, damage claims, insurance coverage? Where do you see this going?
Well, so let's put the sexual harassment allegations aside. And if we just go back to this part about Nassar, about saying, look, somebody at MSU essentially allowed Nassar, directly or indirectly, to abuse women.
Didn't follow through on his own rules
exactly.
of behavior and conduct.
We know that there's more than 140 women and girls who are suing MSU saying exactly that, that look, you as an institution are responsible for what happened to us when we were abused by Nassar. These kinds of charges, even though they're unproven, make that a stronger case for them. What it also potentially does, and we don't know the details about this and won't for a while, is that it also makes it harder potentially for MSU to fund any kind of settlement they get from those women through their insurance. Schools like MSU are insured in case they do get sued. But what we saw in Penn State case is that once some of the administrators were charged criminally, the insurance company backing Penn State up said, whoa, 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 you're not covered for this. We are not going to pay out for this kind of thing. And they did. They came to an agreement with their insurance company. But if you're MSU, this is not a headache that you need right now.
And we should just be very clear. William Strample did step down as dean late last year for medical reasons.
Medical leave is what he took. The interim president, John Engler, is trying to strip him of tenure. Mm. But as far as we know, currently he is technically still a faculty member. And the last time that we checked with the medical college was still receiving his full salary.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. Thank you, Kate.
Thanks, Cindy.
Still to come, we talk with the author of the dystopian new novel, Title 13.
A lot of it was meant to be just jokey, a lot of it just satire, and all of it seems so real now, you know, with rogue Twitter accounts and all of these, you know, things coming to light like that.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time for another edition of Theater Talk. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here now with the latest look at productions from professional theater companies all over Michigan, and you have quite an eclectic mix of shows for us this time.
We sure do. First up is a show I'm very excited to see called The Devil's Music, The Life and Blues of Bessie Smith. It's a play with music. This is a Michigan premiere, and it's at Theater Nova here in Ann Arbor. The story reimagines Smith's final evening after she and her band are turned away by a whites-only theater in the 1930s. A lot of listeners sadly may not know Bessie Smith's work. She was an African-American blues singer of huge and remarkable talent. She was defiant and a bit bawdy in her delivery and style often. She infamously stared down or famously stared down a demonstration by Klan at one of her performances in the South. In the 1920s, she was the highest paid entertainer of color. And to give you an idea, she sold about 100,000 copies of her song Crazy Blues in 1920. Another hit was Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know that tune.
Absolutely.
Let's hear a little bit of Bessie Smith.
Nobody knows you when you're down and out. In my pocket, not one penny. And my friends, I haven't any, but if I ever get on my feet again, then I'll meet my long lost friend. It's mighty strange without a doubt.
And you spoke with director Lynch Travis about the selection of this piece for Theater Nova and why Bessie Smith speaks to audiences in 2018.
Bessie Smith was quite an innovator. She was an enormous star for her time. She was a person who came from nothing, no formal training, that type of thing. And she had this big hit, and she kind of took the blues out of clubs and out into the recording world. And what's most fascinating for me is how relevant it is today, because she was considered controversial during her time because of her sexuality and her openness about racism. And it doesn't really seem like a lot's changed.
And who's in the cast, David?
So Kay Edmonds plays Bessie. She should be wonderful. I've seen her in some things around Michigan, and also, and she's been wonderful in things both musical and non-musical. So I've heard her sing and just act in straight plays. And then Brian Buckner plays her piano player, Pickle, and he is crazy, stupid, talented. Full disclosure, he music directed my play, I'll Be Seeing You. So I'm very familiar with Brian. And Theater Nova is at the Yellow Barn building on Huron in Ann Arbor. And it starts this weekend.
And now let's head north to Alpena, to the Sunrise side of the state and the Thunder Bay Theater.
Yes, and something very familiar. They are putting up Neil Simon's The Odd Couple, which is a perennial favorite. This theater operates all year round, and I'm going to go up to see this production. The last play I was up there to see was The Addams Family. It was very much worth the trip. So my hopes are high for this classic about two divorced men trying to live together. Winter has given over to spring break. My perennials are popping up all over the place. So I'm looking forward to a little waterfront, you know, experience this month.
All right. So that will be at the Thunder Bay Theater in Alpena. And now we head back downstate to Pinckney.
Right. The Dio Dinner and Entertainment Theater, like the Bessie Smith story, taking us way back in time. And they are putting on a fairly new musical called Daddy Long Legs, but it's based on a novel from the early part of the 20th century. And for Fred Astaire fans, yes, this is the stage musical based on the same story of the film of the same name. The story is set at the turn of the 20th century. It's about an orphan. She's a teenager, and she has a mysterious benefactor who is sending her to college. And she nicknames him Daddy Longlegs after her only glimpse of him was this long shadow one day outside the orphanage. And that was what she called him. It is a musical, lots of songs.
It's not about a spider.
Not about a spider. And I got a chance to talk to director Steve DeBrun this week about why he chose it.
Daddy Long Legs is based on the 1912 novel of the same name by Gene Webster. It inspired the 1955 Fred Astaire film, which was loosely based on the novel, taking place in 1950s America, not early 1900s. The film was, while it was running in New York City, was broadcast online across the United States and the world. And we were lucky to catch that broadcast and see this live production of the show coming from New York. And it was just charming and beautiful. And we thought, that's the show. We need that show in our season.
That sounds like a lot of fun. It really does.
Lots of great tunes and not about spiders.
Not about spiders. Next, we head to Detroit, and we're going to check out two shows. First stop, the Michigan Opera Theater at the Detroit Opera House.
Right. And this is Tosca, which is one of Puccini's biggies, and it's a crowd pleaser. It's one of those operas that has everything a good opera should have. Set in Rome, with the Kingdom of Naples, control of Rome, threatened by Napoleon's invasion of Italy. And we have depictions of the good opera stuff, torture, murder, suicide, and also some very classic arias mixed in. Tosca, just for the uninitiated, was a landmark opera for its time in that it showed things in realism. It was kind of breakthrough that way. And the themes and actions I mentioned, you know, murder, also attempted rape, suicide. Some critics dismissed Tosca for just being vulgar. But today, it is one of the big crowd-pleasing operas, along with Carmen, La Boheme, Aida.
And MOT does a lot to reach out to people who think they don't like or don't get opera, don't they?
They do. And I want to mention that they have a wonderful feature on the Michigan Opera Theater website. And they have both an adult guide and a classroom guide to their operas, including this one. So go to the website and spend a few minutes learning a bit, maybe getting up, dressed up a little bit and checking out this opera. You'll feel grand. I always feel grand when I go to the opera at
but
the Opera House.
You don't have to do that.
You don't have to. I've seen people in jeans and I've seen people in fur wraps.
And they do subtitles, don't they?
And they will do subtitles, absolutely.
So you can follow along and then start getting that opera habit. And then we wind up with the Detroit Repertory Theater.
Yeah, it's a play called Harmony Park that opens this week. It's a new play. It's a world premiere about a relationship between a black foreman on a project to convert land to a public park and a younger white landscaper. It's a play written by a playwright not a lot of people know. His name is Daniel Damiano, but he's a bright, energetic playwright who's kind of best known these days for a play called Day of the Dog. It's got a lot of positive reviews around the country. And for those of you who don't know, the Detroit Rep, which is a marvelous space downtown, has a mission. All the plays it does have some connection to race relations, civil rights, and it's really one of Detroit's treasures. And it has operated continuously, I like to remind our readers, since Eisenhower was in the White House.
Boy.
And the same people who started it are still there running the theater.
And keeping that vision intact. Boy, you stop and you think about that. That's something not a lot of companies can say.
That's true.
So just to recap, Theater Nova in Ann Arbor with The Devil's Music, The Life and Blues of Bessie Smith, Thunder Bay Theater in Alpena, The Odd Couple, Neil Simon special, Dio Dinner and Entertainment Theater in Pinckney has Daddy Long Legs, Michigan Opera Theater doing Tosca, and wrapping up with the Detroit Repertory Theater, Harmony Park. You can get the details on all of these productions and more by going to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. When Michigan's economy tanked a decade ago, it produced a steady stream of young people leaving Michigan to seek work in Chicago. Michael Farrow was one of those young Michiganders. His experience working for the federal government in the Windy City was the inspiration for his debut novel, Title 13. And let's just say Farrow's protagonist, a government worker named Heald Brown, finds himself in some very dark places, partly due to vodka, and also because of the Orwellian nature of his job working for the government. Michael Farrow has been recognized with an honorable mention for Glimmer Train's Short Story Award for New Writers. And he received the Jim Cash Creative Writing Award for Fiction, and he is here now. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I saw a review describing Title 13 as a dark comedy, which didn't hit me that way, but I wasn't sure how to characterize it. How do you describe it?
Well, I definitely look at it as a satiric book, especially the first half. The first half of the novel has a very satiric, sort of absurd tone to it. And then it definitely does go kind of down a dark and sort of
Orwellian?
Yes, Orwellian, yes, path as his alcoholism becomes more apparent and the emotional aspect of his family dynamics and relationships come out.
And what time period are we talking about?
It's set in 2010.
All right, 2010, so the not too distant past.
Right.
And your protagonist is this man named Heald Brown, and he's a Michigander who works in Chicago. And where and doing what?
So he works for the Department of Commerce in the U.S. Census Bureau, doing the 2010 decennial census, which is always a lot of fun, doing the big count for everybody in the Midwest.
And why did he leave Michigan?
So he left Michigan because in the book he graduated around the time that the recession hit, and so unable to really find steady work, he decides to head to Chicago.
And as we'll talk about, that is certainly something you know very, very well. And he is an alcoholic, but he's able to get through each day at work.
Right. He's pretty much a functioning alcoholic.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Indeed. And that certainly plays that bottle of vodka is a very important character in Title 13. And things quickly progress to a big, huge crisis in this office of the Chicago Regional Census Center. Tell us just a little about that without giving a lot away.
So Title 13, it's part of the U.S. Census Code. And so anybody who works for the U.S. Census has to be sworn to it by, you know, punishable by law or all kinds of nasty, scary things. And so 37 pages of this information go missing inside of Heald's office. And basically, we don't know why. We don't know where they are. We don't know who took them. So it's kind of the, I guess you could call it the MacGuffin, sort of the thing that keeps the story progressing. But yeah, so this information is missing, and the premise is who took it, where is it, why is it gone, and what does it mean?
And things do get a little 1984-ish as management tries to find those missing pages. Now, you wound up heading to Chicago looking for work. Tell us about that.
So yeah, I went to Chicago, sort of the same thing as Heald. That was my inspiration was, you know, I wanted to find work in Detroit. I personally did work for the state of Michigan for a little while hunting wasps. For the Department of Agriculture, which was a really fun job.
But an interesting use of your creative writing degree from
MSU. Exactly, yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I, you know, unfortunately got laid off from that. You know, there was no budget. So I went on a weekend visit to Chicago, never been before. And just, you know, when you see that after a year or two of living in the recession area of Detroit, it was like, wow, I want to be a part of that.
So you did, and you wound up working for the government.
Right, and I had no job. I had very little money. I was very stupid about it, and I just went to Chicago, and I saw this apartment in the Gold Coast, and I thought, oh, yeah, this is great. This is wonderful. I'll just take my savings and no job. And yeah, luckily, I found a job with the federal government right as my last $10 was leaving my bank account. So lucky and stupid. That's better be lucky than stupid.
And it gave you the kernel for Title 13.
Right, yep.
What do you think you're saying? What are you saying to your readers about the United States of the 21st century through this story?
So when I started writing it, it was about 2012, 2013. It took about a few years to write. And at the time we had Obama and things were great. And it was just a wonderful time. But when I lived in Chicago, I had noticed, you know, there was the rise of the Tea Party and there was a lot of black backlash with birtherism and all this nefarious stuff. And so I started writing a novel that I thought would be more kind of satiric and almost dystopian, but not really, that would focus on this kind of underbelly, this sort of festering thing underneath. And, you know, now that the book is out and Trump is in power, it's sort of come true. There's a lot of the absurd things in the book, which I thought could never happen, have come to be. And it's terrifying.
Such as?
Well, I would say that in the novel, we focus on the weird bureaucracy that happens in the government, especially in the Department of Commerce and the Census Bureau. So just the way that bureaucracy is focused between sort of regional levels of government and the national level of government, the federal level of government in Washington, D.C., there's a lot of, you know, absurd satire in here about that with the civil service workers, you know, and the lamentations that they have. And a lot of it was meant to be just jokey. A lot of it just satire. And all of it seems so real now, you know, with rogue Twitter accounts and all of these, you know, things coming to light like that.
Since Donald Trump became president.
Exactly. Yes. Since Donald Trump became president, a lot of the things that I thought were very far-fetched in the novel are no longer very far-fetched at all.
What's the social message you hope readers will take away from Title 13?
I think our country is kind of lonely. I think we're a lonely country, and all of us inside the country, no matter how connected we are through social media and all kinds of things like never before, we're lonelier than ever before. We're growing distant. We're obviously, you know, very divisive. So this book is kind of trying to highlight that, and obviously through the perils of addiction as well, and trying to find some kind of middle ground almost. Maybe it's satire, maybe it's something else, I'm not sure.
A plea of some sort.
Yes, yes.
Well, now that you've been through the experience of writing a novel, you've got your debut novel published, what advice would you give aspiring writers who were where you were not long ago?
Ooh, I would say you have to write what you feel in your heart. You know, when I wrote this book, I honestly didn't think it would get published. You know, it's literary fiction, it's kind of satire and absurd. So, you know, it doesn't sell very well originally, but I had written it just for me to get it out of my system. And by the time I finished it, you know, then I was like, okay, now I want it published, you know. But you have to tell that story that's sort of, you know, itching at your soul. Yeah.
And then the process of, you know, finding a publisher, working with them. Oh, look at you. You shuddered.
Oh, yeah.
What's the big challenge there?
Well, basically, you have to find the right publisher. I got very lucky with Harvard Square Editions because, you know, they primarily focus on literary fiction that has a social message. So, you know, that's kind of what Title 13 is. It has that social message. It has that impetus behind it. But I would say, you know, finding a publisher is, you know, the big five, or you don't have an agent, you're not going to find them. But there's so many great small independent presses out there. And, you know, you just read a couple of their books. And if you find one that works with your taste, your style, then go for it. Submit to them.
And what has it been like for you to have people read this thing that was percolating in your mind all these years? It's out. It's available in bookstores. What is that like to have somebody come up and talk to you about this baby of yours?
Oh, it's absolutely terrifying. It's the most terrifying thing in the world. No, it's very humbling. It's flattering. It's something I never thought would happen. And I'm so glad that it seems to be connecting with people. I think it just hit right at the perfect time.
And we should note you are back in Michigan from your Chicago years.
Yes, I've been back in Michigan for some time now, living in Ann Arbor and loving it. Great to be back, and it's great that the economy here is doing better.
Michael Farrow, his debut novel, Title 13. Michael, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up.
Spring has sprung, and we have debuts popping up. People are announcing festivals and outdoor shows that are going to be happening later in the year.
We'll check out some new music from artists with Detroit area roots. That comes up in 10 minutes, right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As America gets older, the question of just who's going to care for grandma and grandpa becomes more complicated and more urgent. Consider this. The number of Americans over age 65 will more than double in less than 50 years. Patricia Smith is a professor of economics at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Her piece for The Conversation explores why the daunting economics of elder care are about to get much worse. Patricia, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you're bringing to this story not just your skills as an economist, but your life's experience because your mother has dementia?
Correct. My mother has a type of dementia where we're fortunate she still recognizes us, but she certainly can't care for herself.
And you're saying that situation your family in is really a microcosm of a bigger problem.
Right. For now, we're fortunate that I have a sister who can take care of our mother, but we can't count on that indefinitely. Nor can our society count on family members, especially wives and daughters, to take care of the growing number of elderly.
Which pretty much we've done. And I have to say, I'm going to throw some numbers out here that you put into your story that I thought were jaw-dropping. More than 43 million people providing loved ones with $470 billion worth of care. And that is more than the gross domestic product of 170 of the world's 196 nations. That's not sustainable, is it?
No, it's impossible to expect people to keep providing that much so-called free care, especially because there's more and more old people. Like you said, the population over 65 is going to double soon. The population over 75, 85 is growing even faster because we're living longer. Mm-hmm. And so there's more of us being old. More of us are going to live long enough to get chronic conditions like dementia. And families have been having fewer and fewer children.
That's the thing I'm thinking. As baby boomers get older, the thing that started with baby boomers, having fewer children.
So there's going to be fewer kids out there to take care of growing numbers of older parents. And a lot more older people are entering the retirement years single because of divorce. So a lot of people rely on spouses in addition to their children. And so it's really clear this is a major problem. We can see it coming. Why aren't we planning for it?
Well, and if there's no one like your sister to take care of mom or grandma, well, then we start looking for paid caregivers, or you hope to move your loved one into a nursing home. Let's just start with that institutional care. Too costly for most of us?
It's very expensive. Medicaid and Medicare won't pay a whole lot unless you're sufficiently poor and meet certain conditions. You'd have to move your parent or loved one into, you know, a shared living arrangement. Most of us would, to make it affordable. And that can be very distressing. And most older people I know want to stay in their home. I want to stay in my home as long as possible, too. I can totally understand it. And sometimes it's cheaper.
And I would suspect it helps keep that senior grounded in the reality of being surrounded by familiar things. And so for a long-term situation, better for them to stay.
Yes, especially those with dementia. Like my mother is only comfortable with very familiar things. We have to watch the same TV shows. We have the same conversations. We have the same food. Because anything unfamiliar is very distressing to her. So imagine putting her in an institution with, you know, a stranger as a roommate. It doesn't bode well.
No, it doesn't bode well. So paid caregivers. So what are the economic problems that we're facing right now with paid caregivers? We'll talk about the future in a bit, but right now.
Well, we already have shortages in some part of the country for paid caregivers. So you would think if the labor market worked like we learn in our basic economic classes.
Supply and demand.
There's a shortage because of growing demand. You would think the price would rise and that would attract more people to the caregiving profession. But that's not what we see happening, at least not yet. The wages are pretty stagnant for personal home care aides. They average about $10.50 an hour, comes up to about a little over $22,000 per year. Most of these people qualify for government aid, like food stamps. I mean, it's not a high-paying profession. It doesn't have benefits. It often isn't recognized or have status, respect. And so, of course, people aren't flocking into this. We're not making it very worthwhile.
And thus we rely on immigrants, which leads to the next problem.
The next problem is often about 25% of our paid care workers are immigrants. Often when we have a shortage of labor in a particular industry, we rely on immigrants to fill that gap. But if we are undertaking these policies to restrict immigration to the United States, then we're cutting down on a pool of people who could be helping us with this really critical problem, watching over our elder citizens, people with disabilities also. And we also have the issue of women have entered the labor force in greater numbers. So even if you have a family member who is willing and able to take care of a family member, like my sister's willing and able to take care of our mother, it came at a great cost. She spent many years trying to take care of my mother in the morning, run to do her job, come back at lunch, make sure everything was okay, go back and do her job, come back at night, make dinner, and anything about the housework in the evenings. And so she ended up retiring early.
That's a hamster wheel and a half that you're describing.
Oh, it was very stressful. And so she decided it was less stressful to just spend time with our mother. That would have been more emotionally satisfying to her. But sort of if you look at the opportunity cost, what she gave up in terms of earnings, Social Security, the average is if you retire in your 50s to care for a loved one, you're going to give up about $350,000 in lifetime earnings.
So when her time comes to be cared for, she's going to be at a disadvantage.
Yes, she won't have been able to save as much. So it's a problem, both in terms of family members and paid caregivers. And we can see it. I mean, it's obvious.
Here it is. So if you want to talk about solutions, if you could wave a magic economist wand and institute the kinds of changes that could address these problems, what should we do for today's seniors? Like, what could we be doing right now?
We're all getting older. Our parents are getting older. You're going to find yourself either trying to figure out how to care for an elderly relative or finding care for yourself. It's going to happen. So let's, as a society, figure out what can we do through the private sector and what can we do through the public sector to make it better. So think about companies' dependent care policies. In terms of public policy, let's think about our tax code. Can we make it more rewarding? Can we change the benefit levels in Medicaid and Medicare to pay people more, while at the same time making it more affordable? It will cost us more in terms of Medicaid and Medicare expenditures, but maybe it will save us money in that fewer caregivers would qualify for food stamps and housing assistance, and at least our elders would be getting better, more reliable care because somebody's being paid well to do it. We could think about, we have visa programs to bring in workers for agriculture and for the hospitality industry. Why can't we do that for caregiving? Maybe a path to citizenship for getting a certain amount of training in caregiving, spending a certain amount of years, you know, earning credit that way. Why not?
You'd have highly motivated workforce coming in.
Get a highly motivated workforce with incentives to get trained and to improve and to stay and to contribute. And if we could somehow figure out how to change the gender stereotypes about caregiving, now currently about 75% of caregivers are women, if we could make that job, that occupation more acceptable to men, well, there's another pool of labor that we could tap. But right now, if you, for example, you take a steel worker who been doing very male-oriented work and say, I'm sorry, you're out of a job. Here's another job taking care of these older people. It might be a real hard sell. A lot of men can't see themselves doing that kind of work. Is there some way we can change that to make it more valued, no matter your gender, that this work is valuable?
Patricia Smith is an economist with the University of Michigan Dearborn. You'll find her piece, Why the Daunting Economics of Elder Care Are About to Get Much Worse, at theconversation.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
How do you know if nursing homes, home health aides, and assisted living communities are treating you or your loved ones properly? And what do you do if they're not? We'll have that conversation on Stateside soon. But first, we need your questions. Just what questions do you have about the care you or a loved one gets here in Michigan? What do you want to know that could improve that elder care? Leave us a voicemail. Call 734-764-7840. That's 734-764-7840. And you might hear your question next week on Stateside. It is time for us to listen to some new music from artists with Detroit area roots. And as always, we welcome Paul Young, founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine, and its executive editor, Khaled Badi. Paul, what's our theme this time around?
We're loosely looking at, spring has sprung and we have debuts popping up. People are announcing festivals and outdoor shows that are going to be happening later in the year. So we're really just thinking about kind of like newness and, we're looking at a couple artists who are up and coming from the Detroit area.
Okay. And we're starting out with Michigander. Khaled, tell us a little about this artist.
Yeah. Michigander is the stage name of Jason Singer, and he started the project about 4 years ago, and it's been a sound that has resonated with a lot of people. I mean, his first single, 90s, took off. It became a hit on college radio stations nationwide. It was on official Spotify playlists, which, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Including indie all-stars and viral hits. And from that, it's accumulated 500,000 plays since it landed on streaming.
Well, and Michigander has released his debut EP called Midland. Let's take some time now and check out a track titled Stolen. Paul, what do you like about Michigander? Like his sound, his style?
Great stuff. Highly produced and just really like really careful and really articulate. I appreciate the fact that he has a little fun with himself. He's been quoted as saying he refers to his music as really hard soft rock. but he's also been compared to like the National, groups like Coldplay, and has that really just like that really high studio sound.
It's beautiful and really really accessible.
Yeah, he's on the more user-friendly, mainstream-leaning end of indie rock. It's something that resonates with a lot of people, and it's led to his success with his next single, Fears, and I'm positive that this new EP will be just as successful.
Well, now for something completely different, we head over to Baron Crook's Tangle Parade. Paul, tell us about Baron Crook's.
Baron Crook's Tangle Parade is basically the project name for Josh Cook, who is a really talented percussionist. He's done a lot of like symphonic percussion, a lot of like mallet instruments, and just like really articulate kind of really music-y kind of heady stuff. And he did a lot of exploration in Detroit's kind of like underground experimental scene, which goes pretty deep, let me tell you. I went to a performance that Josh was at, and there's maybe like 10 people in the room, and there's this like really artistic guy like grinding like a pine cone and like a wrench up against a cymbal, and like it's just like very experimental, very avant-garde. And so through some of those experiences, Josh figured, you know, I want to create a project that's maybe a little more accessible than that, and maybe trying to show people like how experimental can bleed into some pop sensibilities. So this is Josh Stab and his first kind of like foray into his solo artistry.
Yeah, Baron Crook's, you know, skirts the line in a different way than Michigander. Michigander leaned a little more on the pop-friendly side. Baron Crook's is pop-friendly too, but coming at it from an experimental angle, and you can hear that in the instrumentation on this track, Belly Ache. It sounds almost like primal. The rhythms are shambolic and sort of ritualistic. It reminds you of, you know, maybe artists like Animal Collective or even MGMT at, you know, their most off-base. But you get a sense that it's like childlike in its wonder. But at the same time, you know that he's a trained musician because of all these competing rhythms.
All right, let's take a listen to some of Belly Ache. This is Baron Crook's Tangle Parade. Paul, where does Baron Crook's Tangle Parade kind of fit in Detroit's pop scene, in your view?
Yeah, certainly, like Khaled said, like, leans a little experimental, and also, as Khaled alluded to, like, very, like, kind of childlike and kind of elementary, but also super advanced, and you can tell just by, like, the you know, the rhythm and kind of the timing of everything that this is someone who really understands music theory. I would say that this is someone that you could probably anticipate seeing, you know, at somewhere like L Club or UFO Factory or one of those places where pop is really leading in kind of the indie world. And we saw Detroit really take off with like garage rock. That's kind of one of their claim to fames. But we're seeing that same like enthusiasm around this kind of experimental pop.
And now we go over to Max Landry. Paul, he is originally from Metro Detroit, isn't he?
He is, and after he attended Berklee College of Music, he relocated to where, unfortunately, a lot of our great artists go, which is New York. So he's based out of there. He's done a ton of awesome work with big, huge names. He's done hip-hop. He's done electronic. But Max is super well-versed. He's an incredible vocalist. He can pick up pretty much any instrument and replicate something that you just want to hum to him. He can pick it up in a second. All I have to say about Max is just look out for him because he's going to be super famous one day.
And Khaled, he performs and produces, right?
Yeah, he's lent his talents to some huge names. Some of them are from the area, you know, like hip-hop icons like D12 and Boldy James, as well as Crooked Eye from Slaughterhouse. And just like Paul said, he also traverses the line with electronic music, and he's been featured by the likes of Tiesto, Armin van Buuren, David Guetta, and the list just goes on and on. So this is someone else, just like Baron Crook's, who came from conservatory training, but is making his name in another world.
And let's take a listen now to some of Landry's latest release. This is Where We Belong.
If I might, a little deeper I can find what's under the surface of my mind. Cause I'm not always thinking, but I know how much I'm drinking, and with every sip I'm sinking back to you.
Paul, is this typical for Max Landry, or is this somewhat of a departure in sound for him?
I would say when it comes to Max, you can expect just super crisp, like as high-end studio sound as you can get. This dude is a professional, and when he releases something, it's thoughtful. He spent his time on it, and everything from the engineering to the mixing, like this guy's a perfectionist. So it sounds like it should be on the radio because, you know, it should, and he approaches his work that way. So I would say that this is right where you can expect Max, and certainly we're really excited to see what more he does in the future.
All right. Well, just to recap then, Max Landry out with his first single of 2018, Where We Belong. Baron Crook's Tangle Parade, the debut project, is from Anybody for Anybody. And we heard some of the single Bellyache. And we started out with Michigander, his debut EP Midland, out now. And we heard a track called Stolen. And you can learn more about today's featured artist and so many more by going to DetroitMusicMag.com. As always, our guides for our excursions into Detroit music are Paul Young, founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine, and its executive editor, Khaled Badi. As always, guys, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thanks.
And that's our stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.